Okay, so now I want to move on to the next sutta, which is called the Soil Remover. And this particular sutta is found in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses of the Buddha, the Anguttara Nikaya 3. And it is another sutta, and this shows you the path of practice from a slightly different angle. It's similar to the previous sutta we had looked at, but it's also a slightly different angle. This shows us more from what we are supposed to do, how we are supposed to practice. This sutta shows you that the practice of Buddhism is a practice of gradual purification. Purify yourself gradually. You may have heard of the Buddhist work, the Visuddhimagga. Anybody heard of the Visuddhimagga? Yeah, Visuddhimagga, right? Visuddhimagga means literally the path of purification. Now, the real path of the purification is what you read about here in this particular sutta. And of course, the Noble Eightfold Path is the real path of purification. The Visuddhimagga that was written by Buddha Gosa, which is the kind of the standard name of his work, that is kind of that is a later thing. It is not the essential path of purification. This is the real path of purification that you find in the suttas themselves. So let us have a look and see what the Buddha has to say about this. I will do as I did before. I will read it out and then I will comment on this as I read through it. Bhikkhus, bhikkhunis, laymen and laywomen, ladies and gentlemen, everyone included. There are gross defilements of gold, soil, grit, and gravel. Now the soil remover or his apprentice first pours the gold into a trough and washes, rinses, and cleans it. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain middle-sized defilements in the gold, fine grit and coarse sand. The soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses, and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, there still remain subtle defilements in the gold, fine sand and black dust. So the soil remover or his apprentice washes, rinses, and cleans it again. When that has been removed and eliminated, only grains of gold remain. Let me just stop there, because that is already, I think, quite interesting, some of the things that is going on here. It's fairly straightforward, right? It's a gradual removing of dirt and dust and soil, etc., from gold to purify the gold. This is what this is all about. Now, one of the interesting things here, this is basically, later on you will see that this simile here is a simile which shows us how we purify the mind, right? So purifying gold is like purifying the mind. This is what this is all about. So the first thing that we will notice here, which is interesting, is that gold is really here the simile for the mind, right? The mind is like gold, right? Very, very interesting how the Buddha uses these words. Of course, in ordinary worldly parlance, gold is one of the most precious things in humanity. It doesn't matter, I think, where you go in the world, everybody likes gold wherever you go. So gold is one of those most precious things that we can have, right? Very valuable for human beings. Everybody wants to have more gold. Nobody has enough gold in this world then. And in the same way, the mind, the Buddha says, that is really our real gold. Just like the most precious thing in the world is gold, the most precious thing in the spiritual life is the mind itself. So why is that? Why is it that, how come the mind is such a powerful thing? But sometimes you look into your mind and think, oh, I'm not sure if this is gold, right? It doesn't feel like gold sometimes. And it's because it is exactly the same problem as the ordinary gold. Ordinary gold, as long as it is defiled, it's full of sand and grit and gravel, all kinds of problems, it doesn't shine. It's not beautiful. It is not really workable. It's not soft. It doesn't have all the good qualities of gold because of the defilements. And it's exactly the same thing with the mind. The mind also, the reason why the mind isn't beautiful, the reason why it doesn't shine, the reason why it doesn't give you huge amounts of happiness, is because of the defilements. That's the reason. So just like gold has to be refined to be able to shine the beautiful, in exactly the same way, the mind, when it is refined, it becomes like gold. Of course, the mind is vastly more benefit than gold. Gold, I mean, who cares at the end of the day? Quite a bit of gold or whatever, it's kind of irrelevant. But the mind, that is true happiness. This is the real gold in life, is actually the mind itself. So very powerful simile there, this idea that the mind is like gold. The most valuable thing that we can have as human beings, the most valuable thing you can have as any being, anywhere, any time, is a purified mind, because it is conducive to real happiness, to real contentment, to everything that you have ever wanted in your life, that you can gain through the mind itself. So this is the real goal that we should be searching for then. So very interesting then that the mind is related to gold in this way. This is the first thing. So remember that. And the reason why sometimes you may wonder, oh, the gold, I can't see the gold is not there. It is there. It's just obscured, right? It's behind all the clouds, behind all the defilements. It's always available. If you are able at any particular point to move away from those defilements, the shining mind appears behind there straight away. Yeah. Whenever you're able to move away, the shining mind comes back, just like the disk of the moon comes out from behind the clouds, right? One of the famous metaphors of the suttas. Just like the sun arises in the autumn sky after the rain of the monsoon season, in the same way the mind shines forth when it gets purified from defilements. So keep that in mind. Now the second thing which is interesting about this, and that is the fact that you will notice here that the cleaning, that the refining of the mind happens in stages, or the refining of gold rather happens in stages. You start with the more coarse things, right, get rid of those, then you do the medium things, then you do the refined things. If you try to remove the refined things first of all, you're not going to succeed, right? You're going to start with the coarser stuff. That's easier to remove than the refined things. And in exactly the same way, when we cultivate the mind, you have to cultivate the mind in the right sequence. You have to look inside of yourself. What are the biggest problems, right? You start with that. And once you overcome the biggest problems, you move on to the medium problems. Go from the medium problems to the refined ones. Go from the refined ones to the ultra-refined ones, right? The kind of nanometer kind of problems, right? And you kind of go down until everything is rooted out and there are no more problems at all. But it's very important to do it in the right sequence. Get the sequence wrong, it's not going to work. So you have to, when you look at yourself, you always have to understand what inside of you really is the main problem. So for example, sometimes you have people going on meditation retreats, like meditating, but they're not even keeping the precepts. Not even, you know, they don't even bother keeping the 5 or 8 precepts or whatever, but then they try to refine the mind by going on meditation retreats. That is getting things the wrong way, right? You're starting off with the refined stuff, but not doing the core stuff first of all. So the sequence here is so important. Start off. Does everybody here keep the 5 precepts in daily life? Yeah. Yes. Wow, that's pretty good. Excellent. That's wonderful, isn't it? It's great when you have a community where everybody practices virtue in such a good way. I didn't listen out for any no's. Maybe there were a few no's, and I'm not sure. But that's okay. But it's inspiring when you have so many good people coming together. This is one of the. This is a complete aside, but anyway, it doesn't matter. This is also one of the things that I really love about our Buddhist community in Perth, the Dhammadhok community. There are so many people. I think we had 1,500 or 2,000 people or something that keep the 5 precepts all the time, right? It's powerful. And it shows you that when you practice things in the right way, when you think about the Dhamma in the right way, it actually has such powerful impact. And it compares sometimes, when you look at certain traditional countries, you know, sometimes people are born Buddhist, they don't think about this, oh yeah, I'll just go along, I'm a Buddhist. Do you practice precepts? Of course not, nobody practices the precepts. And this was a story from Thailand. It was you may have heard this before, but this is a story in Ajahn Chah's monastery. And this is a very kind of rude story, but anyway, Ajahn Shah, it was a very fact day on some big occasion in the monastery. There was all the people from the village, you know, the towns around coming to the monastery, hundreds of people sitting there. And then Ajahn Shah asked them, how many of you keep in the five precepts? Right? And he had to look because it was so hard to see anybody lifting the hand up. And then finally he sees two people kind of in the back of somewhere lifting the hand up, right? And Ajahn Shah was not very impressed by all his disciples. And then he said to them, this is very rude, he said, you are all dog shit. Right? And then he basically, this is what you can do if you are a very powerful teacher. You can get away with things that other people can't, right? If I said that, people would say, what? You bad man, go, we can see you again. But when you have very powerful charisma and you have very powerful wisdom, people think, oh, dog shit, really? Okay, and they take it seriously. They understand that he's coming from kindness, he's not really being rude, he's actually being kind. And this is the power of a powerful teacher. But sometimes we can't rejoice, right? This was the time of Ajahn Shah, and people weren't practicing that well. Now Buddhism is kind of spreading around to various people. People sometimes practice much better now than they did even at the time when Ajahn Shah was around. So rejoice in that. See the beauty of that happening, right? It's a wonderful thing that this is happening in the world. And this is one of the strengths of coming together in a beautiful community like the BGM or Dhammaloka or whatever it is. And you have people who are doing the right thing. And it's by far obvious that this should be the case. But even when you have Ajahn Shah around, it often didn't happen. Anyway, that is it. We're getting completely off track now from what we're supposed to be doing. But that is one of the fun of doing this sort of thing. So remember, gradual removal of defilements, right? Five precepts. Get that really well established. Then once you have done that, we try to purify the mind. Then when the mind is purified to a certain extent, then we can do meditation practice. Then when meditation practice happens, then you can get the insights. Everything, stage by stage, in the right way. One of the ways that I think people sometimes get it wrong is, for example, in the relative defilements of the mind. What are the worst defilements of the mind? We talk about three types of defilements in the mind. We talk about anger, we talk about being harmful to other people, or we talk about desires, right? Those are the three types of things we talk about as defilements. And sometimes we need to understand which one of those is the most important one to focus on. Sometimes people, they do all kind of asubha practice, right, or 31 parts of the body, or they do all these kind of things. But remember that the most important one to overcome, and especially I think this is true in lay life, in monastic life, it's maybe a little bit different, not very much, but a little bit different. But the most important one to overcome is anger and ill will. This is the one that creates the most problems in our life, interrelationships, right? And also it is the defilement that destroys our meditation the most. So please focus on that. That is more important than the sensual desires and these kind of things. And especially in lay life, because in lay life, remember that it depends on how you live your lay life. Lay life can be lived in many different ways. But if you live an ordinary life and you have a relationship and you have a family and all these kind of things, then sensuality is a natural part of that. Because it's a natural part of that. You have like two things fighting each other, right? On the one hand, you go on retreat and then you asubha meditation, then you go back and you enjoy your sensuality again, right? And if you have that kind of act like that on cross purposes, which one is going to win out? Well, the one that's going to win out is always the desire, always the sensuality, because that is where the mind really wants to go. You're doing kind of the 31 parts of the body, but you're kind of gritting your teeth, right? And you're kind of trying really hard. And as soon as you get back home, you think, okay, now I can relax and enjoy myself again. It's never going to work, right? So focus on the essential. And the essential is really overcoming ill will and anger. And it's also much easier to overcome that. It's difficult, but it isn't that difficult. It's all about attitude, it's all about perception, it's all about how we look at the world and other people, and if we do that in the right way, it is actually possible to make some very good headway in that area. And I will talk more about this later on. So this is all about getting your priorities right, understanding where to do the work, which is so, so important on this part. And if you do that in the right sequence, and you will have success, and you will be eliminating the defilements gradually, just like you're doing so with the gold. Okay, so these are the three types of defilements, and we will see in a second how they relate to the mind itself. But then the sutta goes on. The goldsmith or his apprentice now pours the gold into a melting pot, and he fans it, melts it, and smelts it. But even when this has been done, the gold is not yet settled, and the dross has not yet been entirely removed. The gold is not yet malleable, wieldy, luminous, but still brittle and not properly fit for work. But as the goldsmith or his apprentice continues to fan, melt, and smelt the gold, a time comes when the gold is settled and the dross has been entirely removed, so that the gold becomes malleable, wieldy, and luminous, pliant, and properly fit for work. Then whatever kind of ornament the goldsmith wishes to make from it, whether a bracelet, earrings, a necklace, or a golden garland, he can achieve his purpose. Right, so here the mind is now almost fully purified. There's only a little bit of problems left in the mind. And these kind of problems, the very last things that we have had to overcome, this is the sort of stuff you overcome, for example, in the Satipatthana Sutta. If you read the Satipatthana Sutta, you see toward the very end, it talks about how to overcome the five hindrances, how to understand the five hindrances fully, understand what they look like, how they appear, how they arise, how they are abandoned, and how they come to non-arising in the future. Everybody knows about the Satipatthana Sutta? Yeah? Everybody heard about that? Yeah. Usually everybody has heard about that sutta. One of those. So, this is the very last thing we need to understand, the overcoming of the very last defilements in the mind. And then it is interesting how the gold is described when this happens, right? So you melt it, you smelt it, you fan it, and all these kind of things. And these are the kind of actions you do as you approach the samadhi. And whatever that is, that it could perhaps be understood as in the next sutta, which is not here, but which actually found in the Anguttara Nikaya, it talks about three things you have to do to attain samadhi. And it could be that this is a reference to that. Sometimes you apply energy, sometimes samadhi, sometimes upeka, which is like looking on. Possibly a reference to that, but it doesn't matter. Anyway, what you do, you're doing those things that slowly and gradually take you towards samadhi, just watching the breath or whatever it is. And then it says, if you do that, right, you keep on watching the breath, keep on doing the right thing, keep on eliminating those last defilements, then it says, there comes a time, that's what it says. A time comes, right, when the gold is settled and the dross has been entirely removed. A time comes, right? But it's interesting, it doesn't say that, I remove the defilement and then I make the mind pure. It doesn't say that. What it says, a time comes when this happens. This is an important way of actually understanding that this is not something you can really control. What you are doing, you're just practicing it. You're just watching the breath. You're doing your metta practice, whatever it is. And as you do that, the mind gets purified. And eventually, when that purification reaches a certain point, then the goal is completely refined. It's not something you can control. It's not something you are in charge of. It happens as a matter of course. And what that means is that when you meditate, you should never be looking for the result. A time comes. You don't know when it's going to come. Because you don't know when it's going to come, it's crazy to look for the results, right? Because you can't control that. The mind, as you do the practice in the right way, it will just happen. Gradually, the purification will happen. You don't really know exactly what's going on. And one day, because you're doing the right thing, it will happen as a matter of course. So your job is never to look at the results. And you will probably have heard this as well from people like Adam Ram as well. Never look at the results in meditation practice. If you do that, all you're doing is giving rise to desire, giving rise to looking at the future, rather than being content in the present moment. This is exactly what the Buddha is saying here, right? He's saying that don't worry, there comes a time, you don't know when it's going to be. Allow it to develop by itself. Your job is just to be with the present moment, not to look into the future. Easy to say that, right? Difficult to do sometimes. But at least, when it comes from the Buddha, it gives you confidence that this is the right way of doing things. So it's very hard, especially if you get meditation, you get somewhere, you get a bit excited, right? Or it destroys everything. And then it's literally what we have to try to avoid in meditation practice. So the time comes, and when the time comes, then all the defilements have been removed, all the dross is gone, and the gold becomes malleable, wieldy, luminous, pliant, and properly fit for work. Right? These are all very important little adjectives that we see there. Malleable, it means that the gold is like soft, right? It is soft, it can be shaped in various ways, that's what it means by malleable. It is something that is very easy to work with, malleable. Wieldy is a similar kind of word. Often the suttas use a lot of synonyms, the same word again and again. Wieldy and malleable are similar. You can work with the gold, easy to shape into whatever you want. And of course, because the simile here is with the mind, it's exactly the same with the mind. Once you come out of samadhi, once the mind is completely purified, the mind itself is malleable. You can do this with the mind, you can do that with the mind, and the mind will do exactly like you say. Just like a trained dog, you say to the dog, okay, get the newspaper, right? The dog gets the newspaper in the morning, brings it back, or whatever. I never had a dog, so I'm not sure how that goes, how that works, but apparently that's what we see in the comics anyway. So the mind does what you want it to do. And not only does it do what you want it to do, it is luminous. Pali word here is pavasara, and vasara is like emanating light, literally means luminous or shining, the mind is shining, right? This word pavasara is sometimes misunderstood in the Pali Sutta, by people who read the suttas, and sometimes take it to mean some kind of eternal mind which is always shining. But actually it is that mind which emerges once you abandon the defilement, that mind that comes out when you abandon the defilement that emerges. This is the pravastra mind, shining, right? Talking about before the nimittas and the light of the mind, this sort of thing, the shining mind, the beautiful mind that comes out. Just like gold shines, gold is beautiful when it is purified. It is pliant and properly fit for work, right? Same idea that we're talking about now. So now you get some idea of why it is so important to have samadhi first, right? All of these steps are the removal of the defilements and the bringing of the mind, bringing the things to samadhi. Now you can see why this is important, because it is only then that the mind is workable. It's only then that you can actually use it for the purpose. Before that, it doesn't have that capacity, that ability, at least not to the same degree. And I'm sure you can probably relate to what I'm talking about. Sometimes the mind is very uncooperative, you know, you try to read something and it's just all over the place, you can't really focus, right? Sometimes the mind is just really, it is so variable, it's changing all the time, the mind. And you will notice that when the mind is very pure, it also has the ability to focus, has the ability to remember. Memory also is always enhanced by the same process. And then you can use it to make anything you like, right? Bracelets, earrings, etc. Whatever you want to do, the goldsmith can achieve his purpose. So that is the simile, and now comes the how this actually works in practice with the mind. So too, because when a bhikkhu, bhikkhuni, layman or laywoman is devoted to the higher mind, there are in them gross defilements, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. An earnest, capable person abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. This has been done, they remain in them. Middling defilements, sensual thoughts, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of harming. An earnest, capable person abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates them. This has been done, they remain in them. subtle defilements that thoughts about the relations, a family in other words, thoughts about the country, thoughts about their reputation. An earnest, capable person abandons, dispels, terminates, and obliterates that man. If this has been done, there remain only thoughts connected with the Dhamma. Okay, let me stop there, because the last part is a little bit different again. Let me just stop with that. So here, you can see here that when the bhikkhu or whoever is devoted to the higher mind, the higher mind in Pali is the adi-citta. Citta is mind, but adi-citta is like the higher mind. And the adi-citta in Pali is just a term for samadhi, a term for the four jhanas and samadhi practice in particular. So here you are devoted to the high mind. Just like the goldsmith is devoted to getting gold, you are devoted to the higher mind, to samadhi and jhanas. So that is the goal in Buddhism, is the samadhi state. This is the first thing to be clear about it. So he is devoted to this, but there are in him these gross defilements, right? Bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. And this, basically, I think these three things are roughly equivalent to what in the suttas are called the dasa, akusala, kamapata, which are the 10 pathways of bad conduct found in the suttas. If you want to look it up in the suttas, you can find it in places like Majjhima Nikaya 41, I think it is. I think it is Majjhima Nikaya 41, where you have the 10 unwholesome ways of conduct. So these are the coarse defilements. Is that correct? 41?
Salayaka Sutta?
I think that's the one, yeah. I think so. Yeah. Salayaka Sutta, yeah. Okay, so this basically is like the standard ways, right? Bodily misconduct, the idea of killing, stealing, and sexual misconduct, verbal misconduct. Verbal misconduct is very interesting. It's of course about lying, it's about speech which doesn't divide but which brings harmony, and speech which is soft and gentle rather than harsh speech. The last one being idle gossip, right? Instead of idle chatter. Instead of that, you speak things that are meaningful, right? You enjoy reading the suttas, that kind of stuff. Then you have the defilements of the mind, and these gross defilements of the mind are, I think, the ones that I mentioned in Majjhima 41. This is like very strong defilements in the mind, right? And it, I think it specifically says there, oh, may these beings be annihilated, right? I don't like them, may them be destroyed. And sometimes we have these very strong feelings inside of us, right? Sometimes we get very angry about something. Sometimes we think, gee, I should be thinking this, right? Have you ever had that feeling? Oh, this is cool. I'm not really happy with this. And so don't feel bad if you sometimes have very strong emotions coming up. It is very human to have that. I remember there was a research done at one of the universities in the United States. I think it was University of Texas or something like that. And they asked the undergraduate students are always the guinea pigs, right? That was the one that they used for kind of these studies, what was going to happen, because they're kind of easy to kind of herd together, okay, answer this questionnaire or whatever. So they asked these undergraduate students, did you in the last year or so, did you have any fantasy of killing somebody, right? How many of you had a fantasy of killing somebody in the last year? And I think the rate was over 90%. Over 90% of these students had kind of a fantasy of killing somebody, right, in the last year. And it's, you think, gee, that's astonishing. But this just shows you, I don't think that Americans are any worse than anybody else, probably. This is just probably human nature. Sometimes you get so angry, right, and so upset, and things are so difficult in your life. Your boss is so difficult, and your whoever it is so hard to deal with, and actually, you would like to get rid of them altogether. And, of course, most of the time, it just stops with the thought, right? It doesn't go any further than that. But what it shows you that these powerful emotions, these things, they are a in each of us, the potential is there to do really bad things. And this is one of the reasons why we should always have compassion to other people. Because when we can see that the potential exists in ourselves to do these bad things, we shouldn't judge other people so harshly when they end up doing that. And then we can actually have, even though we, fair enough, if you murder somebody, it's probably you need to go to prison for a while, right? Because you're being dangerous. But still, we should have to try to understand that person, that the reason why they did that is because of these incredibly powerful emotions sometimes that arise inside of us. And they arise inside of us because of cause and conditions, not something that we usually can control. So this is, so these things, you know, it's okay. Sometimes we need to acknowledge these things, because when you acknowledge them, then you can actually deal with them. And the same thing with the other aspects here of bad mental conduct is like very core, very strong cravings, right? Like being wanting, envying the stuff other people. Oh, I would like to have, you know, their car. I wish I could have their BMW. I could have a really nice BMW. I wish I had that one. Or maybe even, you know, so that's like the beginning of stealing, when you wish you had the property of others, right? You're not actually stealing it, you're getting close, kind of moving in that direction. Covetousness is the usual word in English that means just that. And then, of course, the last one is wrong views, right? Wrong views, too, is actually mental misconduct from the Buddhist point of view. So having some idea of right view is also very important on the Buddhist path. That, if you want to look that up, I'm not going to talk about it more now, but it is found also in that Majjhimanikaya 41, the Sandayaka Sutta for the Brahmins of Sala. Okay. So, and then you have this very interesting phrase, the earnest, capable person, right? To be able to eliminate things, you have to be earnest. You have to be capable. You have to really want to do these things. You have to understand that it can be done. And you have to apply yourself accordingly. These things are not going to happen just by kind of reading the suttas. You actually have to apply yourself afterwards. And to be able to apply yourself consistently to overcome your defilements, you have to have a sense of confidence about the Buddhist teaching, right? You have to have a feeling that it actually works. And then you're able to apply yourself. Then you're able to persevere. And these sort of things can take a long time. When you first come to Buddhism, you kind of read about this, and you think, yeah, okay, it all sounds very good. But it can take sometimes years before you really apply yourself wholeheartedly to this sort of practice, actually really trying to overcome your defilements. This is the most difficult part of Buddhism, is actually this ability to persevere and to keep going, keep the energy going, day after day, week after week, month after month, year after year, lifetime after lifetime. Right? You have to really keep on going. Forget about lifetime, but they're only, this life now is the one you have, right? Now we can do something. Forget about that, I'm just messing around. But this is the hardest part, because it takes understanding of the teaching in quite a deep sense to be able to commit yourself to that extent that you actually do this. So this is the most difficult thing. And sometimes even in monastic life, you know, you see monks and maybe nuns, they're kind of hanging there, you know, not really kind of, you know, giving it everything they got. That is the only way you're going to succeed at the end of the day. So you have to be earnest, you really have to commit yourself, you really have to persevere, and you have to be capable as well, right? This will often mean that you have put in place all the groundwork, all the basic things so that you are capable. Do you have to be intelligent? I don't think you have to be particularly intelligent. So you can just be, anybody can practice this path, whether you're intelligent or stupid or whatever, it doesn't matter. So if you are stupid, that's okay. So it's good, isn't it? It don't actually have to be, this kind of, it's always unfortunate if you have to have some kind of special qualities to do this. What is more important is your heart, whether you are really into it, or that's what really matters. But you have to have certain capabilities, which means putting in place the groundwork probably. And then, once you have that, then you are able to abandon, dispel, terminate, and obliterate these particular bad states, right? And this is very interesting series of words, right? Terminate and obliterate. This is very strong language. And I will show you in the next sutta, it will become very clear what this actually means. Because when you read that, it sounds like you should use your willpower and you should force. 11:45. Oh, okay. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. I hope it was supposed to go longer. Okay, thank you. Very good. Gee, time goes so fast. Okay. I'll just finish what I'm saying, and we can go for dana afterwards. So the point here to understand that when you read this, you think, this means I must use lots of willpower, right? I can obliterate these bad thoughts, I can obliterate these bad habits. But actually, it doesn't mean that at all. To be able to understand this kind of vocabulary, you have to understand the suttas more broadly. And when you read the suttas more broadly, actually, what this refers to, it doesn't refer to willpower, it refers to wisdom power instead. And once you understand why it refers to wisdom power, it actually becomes very clear how this works. If you use willpower to diminish, to destroy, to obliterate the bad states of mind, all you're really doing is suppressing it. And as soon as you let go of all the willpower, it comes back up again, right? You're kind of holding it down, forcing it down. As soon as you let go of the grip, it comes back up again. This is the problem with willpower. It is very painful, right? It takes a lot of effort. You feel very tired afterwards. And it doesn't really work anyway, because what comes back up? But wisdom power is different. Because if you understand that you shouldn't be doing something by wisdom, if you understand that the state of anger is wrong, and you understand how to overcome it by wisdom, then it is really obliterated, it is really destroyed 100% as a consequence. And this is how you obliterate, this is how you terminate these things. Not by willpower power, but by wisdom power. And I will show you later on during these 3 days how that works by using wisdom power. And it's very beautiful, because when you do that, the path becomes very easy and very light as a consequence, very happy. But of course, it takes training and it takes thinking in the right way to be able to do that. Okay, now we're going to have to stop for dana. Thank you very much for that note, for reminding me, because I thought we were going to keep it much longer, but that was obviously a mistake. So have a nice meal, enjoy yourself for the meal, and then we'll see you back here at 2 o'clock.